Well, it's a great honour to be invited to give the lecture at this opening ceremony. And Mortimer and Teresa Sackler cannot be praised enough, I believe, for supporting a Centre for Consciousness Studies. As Hugo said, I started off trying to understand the nature of schizophrenia, and I decided it was actually too difficult, and I had first to understand the nature of consciousness before I could explain schizophrenia. And then I think I decided that was too difficult, and I had to understand how it is that human beings can interact with each other before I can understand consciousness. And I think I've now decided that's too difficult, and I'll perhaps go back to schizophrenia again. But the study of consciousness, I think, is vitally important. I mean, it's, and I shall try and illustrate this, but to understand the psychological and physiological processes that underlie consciousness are also crucial to understanding what is unique about humans as a species. And furthermore, it is also essential for understanding psychiatric disorders like schizophrenia. Again, when I began, schizophrenia was thought to be a social disorder caused by bad mothering and bad politics. And I was not immune to these ideas, but when I started working with Eve Johnson and colleagues at Northwick Park, we rapidly found things out like hallucinations and delusions, which are clearly disorders of consciousness, can actually be modified by drugs that block dopamine receptors. So here was a clear relationship between a conscious experience and something happening at a very basic level in the brain. And that's really what we want to try and understand. But the other reason that Mortimer and Teresa Sackler are very brave to fund this consciousness center is that consciousness is extremely difficult. And I'm quoting here from Stuart Sutherland, who was the founding professor of experimental psychology at the University of Sussex, and he wrote this in his Dictionary of Psychology, and it says, "It is impossible to specify what consciousness is, what it does, or why it evolved. Nothing worth reading has ever been written on it." And maybe this lecture will illustrate the problem. And I am certainly going to avoid trying to define what consciousness is. I shall talk rather about what consciousness is for, and maybe the sorts of experiments I describe, so this is also a compendium of my favourite experiments, will give you some idea. But given the problem experienced by academic psychologists, perhaps we can learn more about consciousness from popular culture. Before I go on, though, I should mention that, as far as I know, Stuart Sutherland is the only academic psychologist ever to be represented on the stage by Alan Bates. Something which I can no longer achieve. So I want to start off by talking about this interesting case, strange case of the devolving zombie. So since the 19th century, the role of consciousness has steadily decreased. So taking Zoltan's nice slide that we were seeing earlier, there's this one extreme where it says everything is conscious, and the other extreme it says nothing is conscious. And I'm going to, this seems to have been happening over the years. So if you go back to Mary Shelley's Frankenstein, when Frankenstein creates this monster, he gives it consciousness as well as life. I suspect that not many of you have read this book. But if you do, you'll find that the monster has an exquisite sense of self and says things like, who was I, what was I, whence did I come, what was my destination? These questions continually recur, but I was unable to solve them. 100 years later, we have James Whale's Frankenstein with the famous Boris Karloff demonstration of the monster, and by this time he still has vigorous life, but is only dimly conscious. So life and consciousness have now been separated. And 150 years later, we have the classic zombie film where the monster has multiplied into a plague of undead zombies besieging a shopping mall. And all that remains of their consciousness is a desire to shop. This is a quote from the film, "What are they doing? Why do they come here?" And Stefan says, "Kind of instinct, this was an important place in their lives." And you can read this very enlightening article in Critical Quarterly called "I Shopped with a Zombie." Now, this is not a zombie. This you've seen earlier today. This is David Chalmers, the eminent philosopher, who is the inventor of the philosophical zombie. And the philosophical zombie is exactly like us, but has no conscious experience. Now, if you believe that such a creature can exist, it suggests that consciousness has no role, it's an epiphenomena. What's the point of it? It has no function. Now, this I do not believe. This is a belief, not a... I can't say more than that. I believe that a creature with consciousness can achieve things that a creature without consciousness cannot achieve. And the question is, what are these things? So what is consciousness good for? And again, I'm going to follow Zoltan a bit in demonstrating to you a whole range of cases where consciousness doesn't seem to actually have any point, and we can manage perfectly well without it. So at the same time as the zombie was devolving into an unconscious being, neuroscience has been revealing how small a role consciousness has, for example, in the immediate control of our behaviour. So this is the first point I want to make. We have this vivid feeling of being in control of our actions. We have an intention and then we act upon it. But perhaps this is an illusion. So there are several experiments like this. This is one I particularly like. The subject is sitting here. On the other side of the table, there are three vertical rods made of perspex. And as soon as the rod lights up, the subject reaches out and grabs it. And there's a micro switch here so that you can measure exactly when they start to move. You can measure the trajectory that the arm follows. And on a small proportion of trials, the middle rod lights up. Then as soon as he starts to move, it goes out and the one on the left lights up. And you can see the trajectory that he follows. There are two things you can measure. You can measure the precise time at which the trajectory changes. So that's the point where he's noticed, in some sense, the change and has changed his behavior accordingly. But in addition, he was asked to shout out "tan" when he saw the target moving. And this is the timing. So that the time he made his movement correction was about 110 milliseconds after the target changed. The time he called out, he apparently was aware of the change, was about 400 milliseconds. So there's a big gap. And in fact, the time at which he called out the change was often so late that he had already grasped the rod. And people would say, it's very strange, but I found I had already got there before I noticed it had changed. And there are a number of experiments like this and since that time demonstrating that when we reach and grasp things, there is really no conscious involvement in this control. Now, you could say this is not surprising. This is a very automatic act. It would be dangerous to think about it because we would be too slow. So this is a slightly different experiment where what was unconscious was the choice of an arbitrary response. The reaching and grasping is not arbitrary. So in this case, the subjects were walking on a treadmill which had a certain friction. And at this point here, the friction changed and the subjects were told either they had two possible responses to this. They could either keep their step rate constant, in which case they would have to slow down, if that's right, or they would have to change the force that they applied. So you're either keeping a constant force or a constant step time. And they were arbitrarily told which of these to do on each trial. And this is the point where the friction changed. This is the point a few seconds later where their walking behavior changed. And this is the point 6 seconds later where they reported noticing the change in friction. So in this case also, the initiation of an arbitrary response to a stimulus happened outside or out with conscious control. Again, you would say this is a fairly straightforward, low-level kind of action. What about something really complicated, like making an important decision? Shall I buy this Mercedes SEC 420? This is a beautiful car which I regret has just been scrapped. Anyway. And Dijksterhuis and colleagues did an experiment on this. They presented people with a simple or a complex set of choices, one of which was about buying cars. The simple set, you were given 4 features of each car, and then you had to choose the best one. The complex set, you were given 12 features of each car, and then you had to choose the best one. One group was allowed to think about it for 4 minutes and then give their choice. The second group was not allowed to think about it. They had 4 minutes where they spent doing another task. And what you see here is for the complex decision, you made a better choice if you were not allowed to think about it. So this is an example, perhaps, of unconscious processes being better than conscious ones. and one can wave one's hands about and say maybe this is because the unconscious brain is rather good at dealing with a complicated situation where you have many dimensions, whereas the conscious brain tends to fixate on a few of these dimensions and may choose the wrong one, which makes me wonder a bit about whether complexity is a good way of distinguishing between conscious and unconscious processes. And finally, for this section at least, there's the famous Libet experiment, in which, as I will show you, the result was that when people made a decision, an arbitrary decision, to move their finger spontaneously at some point, you could actually detect changes in the brain before they had apparently had the conscious awareness of deciding to move. And the question is, does this demonstrate that brain changes precede the conscious decision to act and therefore we have no free will? Or does it demonstrate how the brain creates our experience of being in control? And obviously I will choose the latter. So this is the experiment. Subjects are sitting in a room and they're asked to lift their finger whenever they have the urge to do so. You measure their EEG, and it was well known at the time that there's this readiness potential. There's a gradual increase in negativity in the EEG, which happens about 1 second before the finger is actually moved. And so you can measure the time between the start of brain activity changing and the actual movement of the finger. Libet's clever trick was to ask subjects to indicate, using a special clock, what time they had the urge to move. And this happened here, about 300 milliseconds after the first detectable change in brain activity, which actually fits quite well with the earlier experiment I was showing you in terms of time. So there's a considerable delay between the appearance of brain activity indicating a movement is going to take place and the subject reporting, "I have the urge to spontaneously move." Now, interesting, Libet also asked them to indicate on other trials when they actually lifted their finger. And interesting, this was actually before they actually lifted their finger, although this is not usually mentioned. So there's a discrepancy at both ends of this system. So the question is, does this mean that we have no free will because our urges to act are entirely determined by preceding brain processes? Now, Patrick Haggart has done a whole series of beautiful experiments, first of all showing that the Libet experiment is essentially correct using different kinds of paradigms, but he has also discovered a new phenomena called intentional binding. So he's using a slightly different task. In this case, you press a button, and then 250 milliseconds later, there is a tone. And he's using, so that's the physical timing of this, he's using the Libet technique to ask people when did they press the button and when did they hear the tone. And he found this effect here. So they claim they experienced pressing the button later than they actually did, and they experienced the tone happening earlier than it actually did. So the action and its consequence are pulled together in mental time, which he calls intentional binding. And he did a very neat follow-up experiment to demonstrate that this was a good interpretation of the result. So he used transcranial magnetic stimulation. That is to say, he applied a very strong magnetic pulse to the top of the head, which causes your finger to move. So you now have an involuntary movement. And this technique has a very loud click associated, for he has to have a control subject where they hear the click, but the coil is the other way up, so it doesn't have any effect, and then they hear the tone. That's the real time, and the mental time is much the same. But the interesting thing is when the finger moves involuntarily and then the tone occurs 250 milliseconds later, you get the opposite effect. So the finger is experienced as happening earlier and the tone is experienced as happening later. In other words, when you didn't cause the tone by lifting your finger, they are pulled apart in mental time. And he's shown other experiments. This is probably too complicated to go into, but basically what he's shown is that events that happen well after you have lifted your finger change your experience of when the lift occurred. So something is happening well after the lift to actually alter your experience of when you lifted the finger. And I'm suggesting that the Libet effect and these intentional binding effects are actually just like visual illusions. So we all know the visual illusions, what you see is determined by the context in which they occur. So the size of objects. These circles are clearly exactly the same size, but if I put these rings around it, as in the Ebbinghaus illusion, this one now looks smaller and that one looks bigger, I hope. And the same size, different size. So this is a well-known visual illusion, and my argument would be in the Libet effect, you're getting a temporal illusion. So the distances in time are being altered by the context in which they occur. Do they occur in the context of an act which has a consequence or an act on its own, for example? And this has been demonstrated very nicely, I think, by this experiment from Stetson and colleagues, where they have something a bit like Haggard's paradigm. You press a button, and 135 milliseconds later, on average, there is a tone. And you hear this many, many times. And after you've been calibrated in this sense, if you then produce... Sorry, it's a light flash, not a tone. If the light flash occurs 35 milliseconds after you press the button, you experience it as happening before you press the button, even though, in this case, you have genuinely caused it. So clearly, our brain can manipulate the way we experience things, and I'm suggesting that it does this to bind together causes and effects in mental time. So in the Libet experiment, intentions are bound to actions. I intend to lift my finger and then I lift it. They're closer together. In the Haggard experiment, actions are bound to consequences. I press the button and then causing the tone to occur. The brain pushes these causes and effects together and is in fact a marker of our responsibility for certain actions. And as with experience of our actions, our motor control, as in all other perceptions, this is not direct. It's something we infer from our prior expectation is what is going to happen and the subsequent events. And to have any experience of agency, our actions must be linked to their consequences, so it's not surprising that things happening after you have acted, which are to do with the consequences, affect our experience of our original act. And through intentional binding, we experience ourselves as responsible for some effects and not others. Now, interestingly, the original experiment by Wollschläger and Haggard and others found the same phenomena when observing somebody else. So when you observed somebody else pressing a button and a tone happening, you also saw intentional binding, whereas you didn't see it with robots, suggesting that this responsibility effect works for other people as well as ourselves. Unfortunately, and they must try harder, they have failed to replicate this experiment. But there are many other experiments demonstrating that we perceive other people's actions in the same way that we perceive our own. So, for example, this is another EEG study. When you're performing a task, when you make an error, there's a big negativity immediately after response when you compare the correct responses to the incorrect responses. And the same thing, although reduced in amplitude, happens when you observe somebody else making an error. So the brain certainly processes other people's actions and our own in a similar way, and what I want to suggest is that it binds actions and consequences together and gives us a sense of responsibility. So our brain's binding mechanism enables us to make a conscious distinction between deliberate and accidental consequences of action, and we make this distinction for ourselves and for other people. And even infants of 12 months can make this distinction. So they recognize the difference between someone trying to give them something and dropping it and someone presenting it to them and then taking it away again. So this is a very basic kind of feature of our conscious experience. It's to do with responsibility for actions. But of course you could say, is the experience of being in control actually linked directly to our feeling of being responsible? And here I want to briefly consider the case of regret. So regret is when I chose option A, but now that I see the outcome, I know I would have done better to choose option B. This is different from disappointment, which is where you choose option A and it's not as good as you expected. Now, interestingly, there's now evidence that regret is not experienced if we are not the agent of the choice. But if we did make the choice, then regret increases with the extent of our experience of agency. And here's a horrible graph demonstrating this fact from Antoinette Nicole, who's a PhD student at the Wellcome Department. So she is measuring the amount of regret, subjective regret that people report after the outcome has been revealed. You could have a measure of objective regret, which is the difference between the option you chose and the option you could have chosen. And the clever part was she varied the extent to which you are responsible for the choice. So the black line is where you made the choice and that was it. Whereas the other extreme, this line here, is where you were one of eight people who all decided which one to choose, and it was done on a majority decision. So sometimes they might go against you and sometimes they went with you, but this is a case where you had made that choice but alongside eight other people. And what you can see is that when you are alone making the choice, the subjective regret highly goes with the objective regret. But when you are simply one of eight people making the choice, this is more or less flattened out and you feel much less regret from the choice when the outcome is revealed. So in other words, this is demonstrating that your regret relates to the extent to which you are in control, you experience yourself as in control of your actions. So our conscious experience of action may not have any immediate effect on these actions, but the experience of being responsible for our actions has a key role, I am going to suggest now, in creating social cohesion. So this is my first function for consciousness. So I'm now going to briefly talk about altruistic punishment and responsibility. So successful group interactions depend upon trust and reciprocity. In other words, you put money into the group, it's shared out, and then you also get money back. And to maintain trust and reciprocity, we need to be able to apply sanctions, which is known as altruistic punishment, because you pay for the privilege of punishing people, to the individuals who do not reciprocate, the so-called free riders. These are the people who benefit from everybody else putting money into the group, but don't put money in themselves. This is the experiment from Ernst Fehr and Simon Geschter, where they have four people, or groups of four, engaged in these reciprocal interactions. And if there is no altruistic punishment, the free riders appear and people start saying, I am not going to put money into the group anymore. Why should I support these free riders? And the amount of cooperation goes down. If you add the altruistic punishment, the cooperation goes up. And this is just to show it doesn't matter which order you do the two conditions in. So clearly, altruistic punishment is important for maintaining social cohesion in these small group situations. So what's that got to do with regret and responsibility? Well, we only apply reward and punishment to those who we believe made their decisions freely. So this is an experiment of Tanya Singer's, where these are the offers that people made. So 50-50 is a very fair offer. You give half your money to the other person. 100-0 is a very unfair offer. You keep all the money yourself. And these are the reward and punishment points. So you give more rewards to people who are fair and you give very few rewards to people who are unfair. And it doesn't matter whether it's you who are experiencing this or whether you're seeing somebody else suffering from this. But the interesting part is these lines here. These were people who the subjects were told are simply reading off a computerized sheet what to do on each trial. They're not choosing for themselves, and the subjects don't apply the reward and punishment points to these people. So the idea is that you have to believe that people are responsible for their actions in order to apply altruistic punishment. So I'm suggesting that our brain creates an experience of action in which our intentions are bound to their consequences. This is what happens in our conscious awareness. This enables us to make a conscious but post hoc distinction between acts in which the consequences were deliberate or accidental. And this distinction is important for assigning responsibility and maintaining social cohesion. So you can see how this theme is building up. This is my particular idée fixe, or whatever you call it, which I'm taking advantage of this captive audience to impress on you all that consciousness is basically social. So the second point is we not only have a vivid awareness of controlling our actions, we have a vivid awareness of selecting between different options. So does this conscious experience enable us to overcome our primitive selfish urges and choose the good option? So this is where I'm taking a sort of the idea, I think, of Thomas Hobbes, that man is basically primitive, brutal, and selfish, and you need these higher order thoughts to overcome this. So the question you can immediately ask yourself is, are our unconscious processes selfish rather than social? And what I want to demonstrate to you now is that actually we're much more embedded in the social world than we realize. So this is a study from Sarah Jane Blakemore where people were scanned while they watched somebody else being touched on the face or the neck, or as a control, an electric fan being touched on the face or the neck. And they were also touched themselves on the face or the neck. And this is the area in primary somatosensory cortex that is to do where touch is processed in the brain. This is an area which lights up both when you are touched on your face and when you see somebody else being touched on their face. Now, what is interesting is that the reason we did this experiment was because Jamie Ward, who's sitting over there and has very sadly gone to Sussex instead of staying at UCL, had discovered a special new kind of synesthesia in which people say, when I see someone else having their face touched, I feel it on my own face. So we thought, this is jolly interesting, and we could do a fMRI experiment and get it published in a posh place. And but what is interesting is that this picture here is the control group. So these people do not experience or do not say, I feel a touch on my own face when I see someone else being touched. So this is something that's happening in our brain, making us experience what somebody else is experiencing without actually ever breaking through into consciousness. And of course, the people with synesthesia, one person in the study in the end, show the same pattern but more so. They show greater activity, which seems to suggest that this can break through into consciousness. But the point I'm making here is this is an example of unconscious processing to do with embedding us in the social world. And there are many experiments demonstrating that we also tend to imitate the actions of others, again, probably unconsciously. This is a very nice experiment from Leipzig, which I don't know whether you can see it properly. So this is a straightforward two-choice reaction time task. You have to lift your first or second finger as quickly as possible, and the cue is a one or a two appearing on the screen up there. So one, you lift your first finger, two, you lift your second finger. If you can see these pictures, this hand, they see the picture of a hand where the imperative stimulus appears. This is a free hand. This hand, these two fingers are in metal clamps. This hand, the thumb and little finger in metal clamps. Remember, the subjects themselves, their hands are completely free. When they see a hand with the two relevant fingers in metal clamps, their reaction time is slower. So simply seeing someone who is restrained in this way affects your own behavior. And it's well known that we automatically and unconsciously imitate the movements of others. This is the so-called chameleon effect discovered by Chartrand and Barr. So when you're having a conversation, you tend to scratch your face or cross your legs roughly in synchrony. And we can now do typical nasty psychologist experiments where one of the two people is actually a stooge who's been told to imitate the other. And when you are imitated by someone, you think they are more empathic and nicer people, and you will actually give more money to charity after you have been imitated, even if the person you ask you is not the person who was imitating you. This is very useful to know when you're dealing with charities. But the critical thing is this only works if you're unaware of the mimicry. If you notice you're being mimicked, you think they're creepy, manipulative. So this is a good thing about unconscious processing. So through these unconscious responses, we become embedded in the social world of other minds, and this makes us more social. And this is a particularly nice example of this, which I can't resist showing you. This is from the psychology department at Newcastle, where, as is in nearly all such places, there is a common room where you can have coffee and tea, and there's a box where you're supposed to put the money for the coffee and tea. And at the end of the week, the amount of money in the box is not quite as much as the amount that has actually needed to be spent. And they did this very clever experiment where each week they put a photograph above the box, either of flowers or a pair of eyes. And as you can see, immediately, without even needing to do any statistics, when there's a pair of eyes above the box, people put in more money. This is a completely irrational response. You're not actually being watched. So I'm suggesting that, in fact, successful group cooperation depends upon unconscious emotional as much as conscious rational processes. Of course, high-level conscious reasoning can overcome low-level processes in decision-making some of the time. So does this actually make us less selfish and more pro-social? And here, I mean, sometimes it does, but I want to give you an example here of the case of moral hypocrisy. So given a choice, people often assign an easy task to themselves and a more difficult task to somebody else. So this was set up, so a subject came in to be run in an experiment. They were told there's another person in the other room who's your paired subject, and here are two tasks you have to do, and you can decide which one you do and which one the other does. And typically, people choose the easier one for themselves. And then if they're asked to judge this behavior, they actually say if they do it, it's fine, but if somebody else does it, it's not so good. So this is the definition of moral hypocrisy. You can then ask the question, does moral hypocrisy come from an automatic and primitive emotional tendency to see oneself in a better light than others? Or does it come from a high-level post-hoc rationalization for one's bad behavior? And being proper experimental psychologists, they didn't use TMS or brain imaging or anything like that. They did cognitive load. So they switched off the executive system by making them remember telephone numbers while they were judging the behavior of themselves and others. And the results are very clear. This is what this is the standard result, the hypocritical result, where your behavior is rated as better than the other person's behavior doing the same thing. When you apply the cognitive, this is without load, when you apply the load, it disappears. So the implication here is that preventing reasoning eliminated hypocrisy. So you would argue that in this case, the conscious we were actually using your high-level system to rationalize why what you were doing was all right, really. So conscious monitoring of our options for action does not have the function of enabling us to behave less selfishly. So what function does it have? And what I want to suggest is our awareness of choosing between different options allows us to explain and justify our decisions. This is another critical function of consciousness. And the ability to justify our actions seems to be more important in some ways than the actions themselves. And in fact, our introspection is actually remarkably weak. So here's another beautiful experiment which I wish I had done myself. So the subjects are presented with two packs of cards which contain pairs of faces. They have to choose which face they prefer. The packs are put face down, and what the face they have just chosen is pushed towards them. But the experimenter in this case is also a prestidigitator. Actually, on 20% of the trials, pushes forward the face. The face he pushes forward, although it's from the right pack, is actually the other face. And on 75% of cases, subjects did not detect the deception and proceeded to justify why they had chosen this face, even though it was not the face they had chosen. This is just an example of how poor our introspection can be and fits beautifully what Zoltan was saying before the break. However, through our rather weak ability to monitor our decisions, we can justify our behavior to others. And I think the function of consciousness in this case is to enable us to discuss our decision-making with other people. And before I go on a bit more about that, I want to demonstrate that discussions about decision-making can affect people's behavior. So this is another experiment I wish I had done. So two groups of students. One group read a passage from Francis Crick saying, "Most rational people now recognize that free will is an illusion." And the other group read a passage from Francis Crick about consciousness, which didn't mention free will. And then they had a series of tasks, but I described to you, they then both performed an arithmetic task on which it was easy to cheat. And the way this worked is typical of psychologists. It would always work in a psychology department because you would say, we've got this task for you to do, but of course we haven't quite finished programming it properly, and there's an error. So if you press the space bar, it will reveal the answer, so please don't. And what they then found was that the people in group one who had been told that free will is an illusion were significantly more likely to cheat. Now, why should this be? I suggest that the experience of acting freely in this situation involved deciding whether to cheat or whether to act fairly. If you believe that free will is an illusion, this would provide a justification for cheating, because you would think to yourself, if I have no free will, then I can't help but behave selfishly. These are people who had not heard my lecture. Now, most people tend to believe lack of free will makes you behave selfishly. So this is quite interesting, because in this case, your high-level reasoning about free will enables you to deny a role for reason. So our response on being told that we have no free will, of course, will depend on our understanding of the nature of free will. And what I've tried to illustrate to you is that our understanding of free will is a cultural phenomenon acquired through discussing our decisions with others. I mean, to go right back to the Libet experiment, the social aspect of this experiment is really quite obvious. You're put into a room, by Benjamin Libet, who tells you, whenever you have the urge to do so, I want you to lift your finger and I'll come back in half an hour. You know very well that if he came back in half an hour and you said, I did not have the urge to lift my finger, he would be very cross. So you're actually having a complicated interaction with him, saying, what does he really mean? I need to lift my finger quite often and I should probably lift it in such a way that he can't predict when I'm going to do it next. So there's a big social contract here. It's not really about free will at all. So in the long term, sharing our introspections about decision making leads to cultural rules for making decisions at the individual level as well as the group level. And finally, I want to present our newest data, which I'm really excited about as always, that introspection about perception also allows us to make much better group decisions. It's not just action that I want you to take home this message about, it's perception as well. So this is an experiment on sharing introspections carried out by my postdoc Bahadur Bahrami, mostly in Denmark. And the question was, can two individuals integrate information from each other just as one person integrates information from two modalities? So for example, there's very nice work showing how people can use touch and vision to come up with a better idea of what the object is than they would with either touch or vision alone. So in this case, we have two people each using vision. Can they combine their experiences to help them understand what's going on? And the experimental design was that the people were in front of two screens connected to the same computer, so they're presented with the same visual image and they respond and they are next to each other, but they're not seeing each other's screens. And this is a typical proper experimental psychologist psychophysics experiment of an extremely boring kind. So you have two intervals in which these five Gabor patches appear, and in one of the intervals, one of them will be an odd one out in that it's slightly more contrasting than the other four. And your task is to say, was the odd one out in the first interval or the second interval, which is technical or something like a two-interval forced choice oddball detection task or something like that. Now, normally when you do this task, which takes hours and hours, it is extremely boring and people don't like doing it, which is why papers of this kind only have three subjects who are the authors. But this experiment, actually, people liked doing because you had two people doing the task, so both people see these things on the screen. They then individually decide which interval the oddball was in. They're then told what each of them has said, and they can talk to each other to decide which they decide is the correct answer. So they talk to each other in any way they like, and then they make a joint decision, and then they're finally told whether their joint decision was right or wrong. Now, how can people resolve their discrepancies, the discrepancies in their perception? So the simplest way is you toss a coin to choose which answer will be chosen. If you do this, the performance of the dyad, the pair, will be the mean of the performance of the two people involved. You could be slightly more sophisticated and you could learn which is the more competent partner, and then you would choose whichever the more competent person says on each trial, and then you would be as good as the best member of the pair. But the model that we looked at was so-called weighted confidence sharing, which is you choose the response of the more confident partner on each trial, on a trial-by-trial basis. And and the prediction was that in that case, performance of the dyad would actually be better than either of the two individuals. And of course, to do this, they have to share their degree of confidence. So they have to introspect about how confident they are and tell each other about it. And they have to develop a common metric. So when one person says, I'm very confident, and the other person says, I'm quite confident, they have to allow for the fact that they may be different personalities. So the very confident in one means quite confident in the other. So they have to deal with all those problems. And that clearly involves at least metacognition, which is some people's synonym for consciousness. And the results are very clear. This is the psychophysical curve, which tells you how good they are. And the steeper the curve, the better they are at detecting which interval the signal was in. And this is just one example where clearly the dyad is doing better. The red line is steeper than either the blue line or the yellow line. It's the two partners. And this is across 15 pairs. This is what the result you would get if you chose the best person in the pair. This is the result you actually get, which is significantly better, and this is the result you predict you ought to get from the weighted confidence sharing model. So the dyads actually perform significantly better than the better individual. And for the aficionados, performance is close to the Bayesian optimum for sharing confidences. Now, the effect depends on communication when resolving disagreements. So subjects must be able to report and align their confidence. So put it, the way I think this experiment works is on a long, boring experiment like this, you'll be good on some trials and bad on other trials because your attention will fluctuate. By working together, you can eliminate the bad trials, which are unlikely to be in both people at the same time. And so by doing that, you can actually produce better performance than each person on their own. So it's not that surprising a result in a sense, but it does demonstrate that by sharing our introspections, we can actually make good and better group decisions. So finally, to answer the question, what is consciousness for? First of all, there's awareness of action. And this creates experiences of agency and responsibility for self and others, which is critical for social cohesion. Secondly, there's awareness of choice, permitting the discussion of motivations and strategies for decisions, which creates cultural norms for making decisions. And thirdly, there's awareness of sensation, and this permits the sharing of experiences and the generation of a shared reality, which is probably better than, more accurate than the individual reality, and in a sense is what the scientific endeavour is really all about. So what is consciousness for? Consciousness allows us to create group knowledge and optimize group decision making. Consciousness is fundamentally social. Thank you very much.